You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ki te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, maronga irirangi poho mō tēnei rā, te rā o whā o hui tanguru. Kia ora, you're tuned into 95 BFM and you're listening to The Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, for today, the 4th of February. And I will be with you for the next hour, again alone in the studio. Ariana Piper-Helian is not feeling well and we wish her the very best. But on the show today, Auckland Transport fares are going up and we have the editor of Auckland Transport and Urban Design blog, Greater Auckland, Matt Lowry, live here in studio. International Desk will report on Myanmar and we will also have our weekly chat with Health Minister Andrew Little. And to round the show off, Privacy Commissioner John Edwards joined me this morning to talk about his probe on landlords collecting excessive information on tenants. As usual, at Aha Ofakaro, you can get into touch with me throughout the show. The text machine is open on 5395 and the phone is open on 309379. And you can catch more of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website after the show. I tēnei wā tonu, let's get into it.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Fares on Auckland's public transport are set to go up this Sunday, with prices going up 4% or around 35 cents for commuters. But at the same time, AT is also cutting prices to its one-day pass from $19 to $18, introduced a $20 daily cap on fares and made a 10% discount to off-peak travel arrangement permanent. Joining me now is Matt Lowry, the editor for urban design blog Greater Auckland. Tēnā koe. Can you hear me, Matt?
I can barely hear you. Sorry.
Joining me now is Matt Lowry, the editor of urban design blog Greater Auckland. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yourself?
And very good as well. So what do you think about these changes?
It's obviously very difficult for public transport users who are now having to pay more to make the same trip. It's a situation that no one wants to be in, and in many ways our agency has been put in between a rock and a hard place. You know, the costs of running public transport have been going up, and it's even worse now because there are fewer people catching public transport as a result of COVID, and then at the same time there's only limited funding available, so they're sort of putting commuters between squeezing commuters to try and make up for that, when really the government needs to be covering more of the costs of public transport.
Do you reckon that these rising public fares will just drive more commuters to their cars instead of public transport?
Sorry, you keep cutting out.
Oh, apologies. Do you think that these rising public fares will just move more commuters to use their cars instead of public transport?
Absolutely. So what we're likely to see happen is a further reduction in the use of public transport as a result of the fare changes, and that's something that we need to be doing the absolute opposite of at the moment. And as we try and respond to the climate, try to respond to climate change, and also just congestion and other things around the city that we're trying to get more people moving around. So we want to be encouraging as many people as possible to use public transport. One of the things that Auckland Transport has suggested is that with the increase in fares, it's going to reduce usage by at least 500,000 trips a year. And we put that on top of similar or even higher amounts in the last 3 to 4 years, and that quickly adds up to a lot, for many millions of trips that fewer people are taking as a result of fare changes.
Right. And based on that, should the council need to bump up car-related charges like parking to make public transport a more viable alternative? And recently there is a plan by the council itself to implement road charges as well.
Yeah, I think that the Auckland Transport should be looking at reviewing things like parking charges at the same time as fares. So it seems odd that we increase fares at this time, but then we often don't change parking prices at all. So if we're trying to squeeze money from one sector of the transport, community, and not touching other parts where that could also help impact usage and drive more demand towards or encourage more people to use public transport. We need to be rolling out increasing charges at parking places, and at the same time, we also need to be rolling out to more places as well. So many of our streets are overburdened with parked cars, and we need to be managing that better as well.
Now, the government has said last week that it wants to electrify the public bus fleet by 2035. Do you think that decarbonising public transport will cause even more price increases?
What we know is that electric buses do cost more to buy, and the government are looking at providing some subsidies around it to help cover the costs of those, so that's really positive. But once we've got those buses, they're actually much cheaper to operate, and so we get benefits on that side. So Auckland Transport expect that the cost of public transport will increase, the cost of providing public transport will increase to cover these costs for a few years, and then after that they will actually start reducing because they're much run.
Right. Matt Lowry, editor of Greater Auckland, thank you very much. And that was Matt Lowry from the Greater Auckland talking about the price increases of public transport here in Auckland. These prices will be effective from this Sunday, the 7th of February. You're now listening to the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, on 95 BFM. It's 11 past noon. We are going for a quick break.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
No idea.
Okay, what about tree trunks and six?
What does that even mean?
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
I know tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's comedy night with Corey Gonzalez-McCure and friends, followed by DJs Log Cabin and Bobby Bazooka.
Go on.
And tomorrow, DJs Hudge and Andy JV.
Sweet as, one of those actually solved 13 across. Cheers. Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
14 Nuns, Jeans, Kingsland. Going down the deep south for uni, grab yourself $40 shorts, $50 Sherpa, two table jeans for $140. Get in while stocks last. 377 New North Road, Kingsland, Auckland. Or shop online at 14ounce.co.nz. A brand, rollers, new.
Just a trim today?
Just a tidy up, thanks.
Have you thought about a fringe, though?
Yeah, no, not really.
Just a little fringe, maybe? Just a funky wee fringe?
Look, go on then.
Oh, cover up that big old forehead.
Auckland Live's Fringe Town is coming to Auckland Town Hall February 15th to the 21st. We're giving away tickets to see Mai Moore and Takita, Imugi and Zook. Stay tuned to 95BFM and keep your B-card handy to be in to win. Fringe Town. Find out more at aucklandlive.co.nz.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the report released by the Cancer Control Agency earlier this week, which said Māori are twice as likely than non-Māori to die from cancer, as well as a new investment fund announced by him for Ngāpuhi, as well as his comments 2 weeks ago to strip local councils of their water fluoridation powers and give them to DHBs instead. Here's the Minister. The Cancer Control Agency report on Tuesday, which found that Māori are twice as likely as non-Māori to die from cancer. So what do you make of the report's findings?
The report was a stock take, so it's about just aggregating a lot of information and knowledge that we already have and putting it in place. One of the reasons we set up the Cancer Control Agency was because we had this pretty inconsistent, pretty variable approach to cancer prevention, diagnosis and treatment around the country. So this now gives us a good starting point. But the thing that blew me away was that comparative statistic that Māori are twice more likely to die from cancer as Pākehā. That tells you we've got a long way to go to make sure that the way we set up our cancer regime is truly equitable. At the same time as we're considering a cancer strategy, we're doing broader health reforms, and part of those health reforms is a Māori Health Authority. And my expectation is that that authority would have an integral role to play in ensuring that what we do, whether in cancer or in any other health treatment, is going to truly address those inequities that we know exist in our health system.
Are you surprised to see that Māori are twice as likely than non-Māori to die from cancer, or do you expect the report to find such statistics?
It surprised me that that's how apparently obvious the inequity between Māori and Pākehā is. I know that as we've been rolling out the bowel cancer screening program, that there has been concern that the threshold age at which it, you're entitled to it is too high for Māori. Māori tend to be diagnosed with bowel cancer at an earlier age on average than Pākehā. And so one of the challenges we've got as we roll that out is actually to make some adjustments to those entitlement thresholds. But I think we'll find a similar thing in a whole lot of types of healthcare and health treatment and diagnosis and other areas as well. So it wasn't a surprise to me for the report to show up some inequity between Māori and Pākehā. It was a surprise and a shock to see just how pronounced that was when it came to cancer treatment.
What is the government going to do to rectify these inequities on cancer?
Well, addressing health inequities is a priority for me and the government and the broader health reforms that we're doing. So we want to make sure that we have a health system that we're at the decision-making level, policy and operational, that the needs of Māori are not treated as secondary, that they actually are integral to the decision-making we have. In terms of cancer, the whole reason for setting up the Cancer Control Agency was to get some consistency, get a whole of country view about what is happening, where the gaps are, what needs to change, and to work up a strategy that the Cancer Control Agency is then going to oversee and monitor and call us to account on. So with the benefit of the report, they've now produced this top-take report, we are now in a position to start thinking about what that strategy looks like.
Right, going into the more specific details that the report has outlined, it said that Pharmac only approved 6 new cancer medicines for funding during the last financial year, which is very far behind than other wealthy countries such as Australia. They approved 66 medicines compared to us. Is the government going to do anything to for Pharmac, like boost funding or even change the entire funding model?
Well, there's two things happening. Well, one thing, we have put additional money into Pharmac specifically for cancer treatment, for cancer drugs. So we have done, we've heard that call for that and for Pharmac to kind of catch up in terms of the suite of drugs that it has available for cancer. The second thing is that we have pledged a review of Pharmac on the process of putting together the terms of reference for that. I think for all the good that Pharmac has done in terms of medicine procurement, there clearly are some concerns and it is right to put in place a review to check that the way Pharmac is operating and what they're doing is good overall in terms of New Zealand health and it's comparable to what's happening in other countries. So that work is underway. Whether or not any more funding will go into Pharmac is a budget question and budget issues are, now's the time here when we're putting together the budget. But I'm not in a position to talk about that until the budget itself is announced.
Right. Moving on away from the Cancer Control Agency report and onto the investment fund for Ngāpuhi that you announced yesterday. So can you tell us what this fund is about?
Yeah, so this is a capital fund at $150 million. It's really, it's at that level, the proportion of what, if I applied the TRFT formula for treaty settlements, might be the case for Ngāpuhi, but it's really just accepting that we're engaging Ngāpuhi and we're talking about mandates and how we get to the negotiations for redress of treaty breaches underway, but that's been a long time coming. In the meantime, I know that there are opportunities going begging, particularly in the Rohe, that no Ngāpuhi hapu has the means to take advantage of. So this is a way of saying, well, let's set up this fund. As opportunities, investment opportunities arise, let's make those investments. These will be held for the benefit of Ngāpuhi. If at the point we reach agreement with Ngāpuhi on redress and whatever form that takes and with whatever groupings of Ngāpuhi it takes, that is there available to be part of any redress in the agreement. It really came out of an experience we all had a couple of years ago when there were some orchards that were available and for sale in Northland that were in the Ngāpuhi Rohe. And some Ngāpuhi hapu were interested in it, but none had the means to make that investment. And then it turned out that an iwi from another part of the country was interested in purchasing them. And I just thought, that's not right. And in the end, they didn't proceed with that purchase. But it kind of highlighted to me that there are potentially opportunities going begging that now probably can't take advantage of at the moment. And actually the Crown ought to assist them to take advantage of those opportunities if they want to at some point in the future by having the means to purchase those sorts of opportunities now.
Is the Crown intending to include this investment fund as part of any treaty settlement, or this will exist regardless of if any settlement is concluded?
Whatever is held by the fund, or the entire fund itself, will be available for any agreement reached with Ngāpuhi or the Hapū of Ngāpuhi. Equally, if the Hapū of Ngāpuhi don't want it, or want to have their redress in a different form or different means, then that's fine. And then eventually all these assets would be sold up and that's fine. But it's really saying Ngāpuhi is missing out on value now. Here's a way of just getting the ball rolling, getting some particularly business assets like orchards, like farms, like forestry, and giving ourselves the means to acquire those for Ngāpuhi and held on behalf of Ngāpuhi and transferred to Ngāpuhi if that's what they want at some point in the future. If they don't want it, then they won't get it, and then there'll be other means that will provide that redress. But it's really just making sure that we have some choice available at the point that we have agreement with the Hapū of Ngāpuhi.
Right, and on the negotiations itself, what are the current developments?
The Hapū of Ngāpuhi are talking about mandate, amongst themselves and within themselves. So as I said at the time that I announced the withdrawal of the recognition of the Tūhurunuku mandate, it'd be entirely up to Ngāpuhi how they wanted to come together and what groupings they wanted. So they are forming their own groupings of Hapū. They're coming together, and I think there's some positive developments. I think in the next few months we will see, and maybe in a position to start the process of actually having discussions under duly recognised mandates with parts of Ngāpuhi about redress for treaty breaches. But let's see how this year goes.
On to my final topic for this week of water fluoridation. Now, 2 weeks ago at the Labour Party caucus retreat, you said the government is planning to give water to strip local councils of their water fluoridation powers and give them to DHBs instead. Why is the government planning to do that?
We've been talking about that for some time, and that's because I think in the end, fluoridation of water is actually a health issue. It's one of those preventative measures that can take place, and the councils have had that responsibility in the past, largely because they tend to be the owners of the water supply systems. But they've also proven themselves pretty variable across the country when it comes to considering the issue of fluoridation. Every bit of scientific and expert advice we get, and certainly I've had since I've been health minister, is that the one thing that we can do that will make a phenomenal improvement and dental health in New Zealand, particularly for young people, is fluoridated water. We currently don't have fluoridated water supply. Now, it is a health issue, and it is right for those charged with making sure we have good health initiatives and health policy in place to do that, which is why it is right to go to DHBs.
Right, but some groups like Fluorid Free New Zealand and an open letter to you said New Zealand should not fluorinate our water because fluoride is, and I quote, a neurotoxin and it's toxic. What is your response to that?
Yes, in significant volumes it certainly is, but the volume in which it is used to fluoridate water supply for improved dental health care, actually it isn't. And that's been proven over decades and decades and decades of use in water supplies around the world. I said at the time, look, we have to have a public debate about this because there are very loud voices who are opposed to it. And we should all have a good look at the science of it and the evidence of it. What we can't do is be kind of selective about it and make sweeping statements like that without putting a proper context around it. The volumes at which fluoride is put into water supplies is at such a low level that it isn't toxic, but it can make a difference and does make a difference to dental health care.
Right. Apart from water fluoridation, is the government also going to make changes to other aspects to, let's say, make more affordable oral health care to improve our health statistics?
Yeah, look, that's a good question, and it is. It's a big policy area. It is, I think, you know, one of the areas of healthcare and publicly provided healthcare where there is a huge gap is in oral healthcare. We do very little in terms of publicly supported oral healthcare. We do for under 18-year-olds. They get, you know, free dental checkups and stuff, but generally for adults, we don't. And we know that there's issues about quality of dental and oral health care for older ages. So, look, that is something I am very keen to look at. The priority issue at the moment is the kind of the broader health reforms and the structures within which we make those sorts of decisions. But at some point down the track, we are going to have to confront, you know, just the situation with our oral health care and see what further support can be provided on the public purse.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ki te whakarongo koe ki te waia maronga i rerangi pō. That was Health and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little. And don't forget, you can let me know your thoughts on all the topics that we discussed earlier, including public transport fares, the Cancer Control Agency report, a development fund for Ngāpuhi, and water fluoridation in being stripped away from local councils and put into local DHBs instead. And as just a general reminder, our text number is 5395 and our phone number is 309-3879. But it is time for another break. It's just up to 26 past noon here in Auckland. Tamaki Makaurau, you're listening to BFM.
Justin Wong. It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Welcome back to The Wire. This week on International Desk, we are travelling to Southeast Asia, to Myanmar, where there has been a military coup against the democratically elected government. Myanmar's military had launched a coup against the country's democratically elected government and seized power, detaining President Win Myint and State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi. Earlier this week, on Monday morning, military-owned TV stations announced that power has been transferred to the military's commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, while ministers of the democratically elected government and members of the National League for Democracy Party were detained. The military also imposed a curfew and a one-year state of emergency and replaced the government with a junta composed of 11 members. It also said it will be organising, quote, free and fair multi-party general elections once the emergency is over.
In order to perform scrutiny on the voter lists and take actions, the authority of the nation's lawmaking, governance and jurisdiction is handed over to the Commander-in-Chief. According to the 2008 Constitution, Article 418.
As of yesterday, documents showed that Aung San Suu Kyi has been charged with illegally importing and possessing walkie-talkies in her home in the Burmese capital of Naa Pi Thau, while President Win Myint was accused of breaking pandemic social distancing rules by meeting supporters in a motorcade during last year's elections. This power grab comes before a new parliament is due to sworn in and after last November's election, which Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won a landslide against the military-backed Union Solidarity and Development Party. But the military immediately claimed after the election that there is electoral fraud and did not roll out a coup, despite there is no evidence supporting their claims. Al Jazeera's Ali Fao reports.
Tension on the streets of Myanmar this week as the country braces for a possible political crisis.
We're not saying the military will take power, but we're not saying it won't either.
This was the moment that it all began. In a press conference on Tuesday, military spokesperson Zaw Min Tun refused to rule out the possibility of a coup. The following day, military chief Min Aung Hlaing stoked fears when he said the constitution should be repealed if it was not abided by. The comments follow weeks of complaints from the military of voter fraud in November's election and demands for an investigation.
But the Burmese military's strong influence in politics dates all the way back to the country's independence from Britain in 1948, when it was founded by General Aung San, the architect of modern Myanmar and the father of Aung San Suu Kyi herself. Well, how he achieved Myanmar's independence from Britain during the Second World War and aftermath is a remarkable story, but frankly, that's for another time. Despite Aung San was assassinated in 1947 in a plot orchestrated by U Saw, who is Burma's last prime minister during British rule before the Second World War, his popularity as the founding father of the new republic gave the military the reputation as the institution that liberated the nation from British colonial oppression. Fast forward to 1962, the military led by General Ne Win overthrew the civilian government and began a two-decade-long totalitarian one-party rule, which banned all opposition and introduced the Burmese Road to Socialism ideology that nationalized almost the entire Burmese economy and led to the country's near-total isolation from the international community. Any resistance was brutally suppressed, with the military cracking down on the student protests in 1988 that killed thousands of people. Here's the BBC's Jonathan Head.
Months of sporadic protest mushroomed on the 8th of August into a mass uprising against a despised military government. It wasn't just students. Burmese people from all walks of life came out to demand democracy. But the military responded, as they had before, with lethal force.
Despite agreeing to transfer power back to a democratically elected government that saw Myanmar having its first elections just 5 years ago in 2015. The current constitution that was adopted in 2008, and curiously enough, written by the military junta back then, still allows a strong military presence in the government. It reserves a quarter of all parliamentary seats for serving military officials, which gave it the power to veto any constitutional changes proposed by civilians. And this arrangement basically strong-arms the civilian government into supporting policies backed by the military, especially on repressing ethnic minority rights, which led to Myanmar and Aung San Suu Kyi herself, despite winning a Nobel Peace Prize for human rights, condemned internationally for keeping silent on the humanitarian crimes committed against the Muslim Rohingya minority. Yes, and internationally, there has been quite strong condemnation towards the coup. The UN has condemned the coup itself, and as well as New Zealand, with Foreign Minister Nanaia Mohuta saying that, including New Zealand's Nanaia Mohuta, calling for the swift release of those political actors detained, including State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and President U Win Myint, and for a rapid return to civilian rule. The US also has also condemned the actions conducted by the Burmese military, with White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki and Secretary of State Antony Blinken also releasing statements denouncing these actions. And the President, Joe Biden himself, he said in a statement on Monday that, quote, for almost a decade, the people of Burma, that's another name for Myanmar, have been steadily working to establish elections, civilian governance, and the peaceful transfer of power. That progress should be respected. And he also said the United States removed sanctions on Burma over the past decade based on progress towards democracy, and the reversal of that progress will necessitate an immediate review of our sanction laws and authorities, followed by appropriate action. Yes. And just for an anecdote, the decades-long sanctions placed on Burma, on Myanmar, were reversed by the Obama administration, where President Biden was vice president. But on the other hand, China has been very careful with its wording on describing the events in Myanmar, with state news agency Xinhua and Global Times, when reporting on the events on Monday, they did not describe it as a military takeover or a coup, but simply by saying a major cabinet reshuffle. And on the other hand, them, alongside with Russia, have already blocked a UN Security Council statement that condemned the military coup that happened there. But why is that happening? Well, it's always a little bit of geopolitics being played on, because since what happened with the Rohingya minority under a couple of years ago, Myanmar was once again getting isolated from the international community, and Aung San Suu Kyi had very little choice and have to turn to China for Beijing to protect them, protect their diplomatic interests at the UN, and to block any statements condemning that the country had conducted any humanitarian crimes against any ethnic minorities. And in return, now because Aung San Suu Kyi's government has been removed from power, and China probably needs to avoid any wording that portrays the military junta in a negative way to maintain their friendly relationship with Myanmar. And yes, we will be keeping an eye on this, and it's a developing story.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
was International Desk. The time is 20:01. You're listening to the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM, and we will go for another break.
Thank you. Hey, picking up an order for Jess.
Yep, that's a quinoa salad and caramel brownie. Perfect. I also ordered some incredible savings. Is that coming?
The savings are baked in already. Wink.
Did you just say wink?
Change the way you save with Foodprint. Download the app today, and just by ordering fresh, delicious food, you'll be helping to reduce food waste. High quality, low price, great for your wallet, great for the planet, just great food. Get your lunch on Foodprint today.
No candlelit dinners, no commercial mush. Celebrate Anti-Valentine's Day at MOTAT with fun, dancing, karaoke, live music, the Love Police and all sorts of antics. MOTAT Anti-Valentine's, Saturday, February 13, 7 to 11pm. Tickets just $20 or $15 for students from motat.nz. R18.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And finally, Privacy Commissioner John Edwards said this morning he is launching a probe into what personal information landlords demand from prospective tenants and how they use it. I spoke to him about it this morning, and I began by asking how some landlords breach the privacy of tenants. So why is it a breach of privacy to ask tenants to provide bank statements and place quote-unquote bad tenants on Facebook pages?
Well, starting at the beginning, agencies are supposed to only collect information they need. So this is called the data minimization principle. A number of tenants have reported to us that they're being asked to provide what they regard as excessive amounts of personal information, things like their social media accounts, details of their friends and family. So excessive financial transaction information. A landlord might have a legitimate need to have evidence of a prospective tenant's ability to meet their rent obligations, but that doesn't necessarily mean studying every element of their financial life, including where they spend their money. All they need to know is how much you're earning, how much you're spending, is there enough there to meet your obligations to this tenancy. So that's the first point about the over-collection of information that we're looking into and are a bit concerned about. The second point that you've asked about is the alleged blacklist. Now, we haven't looked into these in detail, but we are concerned of reports that some property managers and landlords are pooling information, sharing it, which can have the effect of excluding people from the rental market without them even knowing that that's happening or knowing the basis on which it's happening or having the opportunity to comment or correct inaccurate information. So we're interested in knowing what they think the legal basis for that is. Are they telling people who sign up for tenancies that they are part of these kind of networks? What are the steps they're taking to ensure the accuracy of information which is put into these databases? And these are quite important points. Any tenant who believes they have been included on a blacklist is entitled under the Privacy Act to ask those agencies to tell them what information they have about them, and they should do that.
Right, but basing on that, how much information is actually okay for a landlord to collect about their tenants?
Well, they're entitled to collect as much as they need and not more. Now, I know that sounds a bit grey. There is an element of greyness in there. What we're going to do over the coming months is understand what the practices are out there, the variety of practices that landlords are using, what tenants' expectations are, and how the legitimate needs of landlords can be met in ways that are still respectful of tenants and not over-collection. So we're going to have to put in a bit more explicit guidance, I think. We tried this a couple of years ago. We put out some guidance which said, here's some stuff you should never collect. Here's some stuff which, you know, maybe you collect at the final point of screening a favoured tenant, but not as a precondition to inspecting a flat. And here's stuff that it's always okay to collect.
Right. You said earlier that under the Privacy Act, a tenant is entitled to know if they're being if their private details are being put on some Facebook groups. So if a tenant out there suspects, oh, I think my name might be on some Facebook groups, what should they need to do to inform their landlords to release this information to them?
They just need to write to them and ask them. They can actually use a tool that we've developed and put on our website. It's called About Me. So you go to privacy.org.nz, you find the link for About Me, and that allows you to direct your query to your former landlord or your current landlord or the property manager or the Facebook page or whatever it is, and to say, please disclose under the Privacy Act everything that you have about me. And that will then go to that agency, and it will give guidance from our office about what their obligations are having received that. And if they don't hear back within 20 working days, they can get in touch with us and we can contact the landlord and remind them about their obligations.
How do we ensure that tenants will understand their privacy rights? Like the information that you told me earlier doesn't seem to be widely available.
Yeah, it's such a wide and diverse market. It's hard to reach all tenants with accessible information, and it's something that I think we need to be doing better. We're going to work with landlords associations and the property managers, different collectives. We'll try and work through tenants associations as well and community law centres and make sure that everybody's got good information about what the rules are and where those limits are.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
That's all for the Thursday Wire today, the 4th of February. Thanks to those who talked to us today. We have Health and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little, the Privacy Commissioner John Edwards, and Matt Lowry of Greater Auckland. And thank you to those who called in, texted in, and tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou a Tera Wiki. Enjoy your rest of the week and have an excellent long weekend. Sigrid is here for the 124 and I'll leave you with her. You tuned in to 95BFM. See you next time. Mate wa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.